Hi, everyone. Welcome back to the Nuance Needed podcast. I'm Amanda White.
And this is Sam Dalton. And this episode is going to be a deep dive into my trauma around being a caregiver, but not just my trauma, but we're talking about the experience of caregiving. That's a topic that a lot of people have asked us about. So the first half of the episode is me sharing kind of my personal experience with it and kind of giving an insight into my brother, his situation, the things that I need to do to help care for him. And then the second half is kind of going into caregiving as a whole and how it can impact us, how it can hurt us, uplift us, empower us, be a good thing, be a hard thing, all of it in between. So without further ado, here's the episode.
We're here today to talk about caregiving.
So this is one that a lot of people have asked my insights on because I am a caregiver, I would say. I think that's fair.
Yeah. You help a lot.
I help quite a bit. I think this is a topic that goes very broad. Caregiving applies to being a parent. Caregiving applies to taking care of sick parents. If your parents are elderly, if they're having health issues, taking care of them. This has to do with people who have health issues, are involved in accidents, have disabilities, have cognitive disabilities. And I think I'm seeing a lot more of that. And I've had some people reach out to me and ask for my experience and like insight on caregiving and what it is and what it means and all that.
Well, I think you're unique, Sam, in that it was always a part of your life. And I would imagine you don't have a clear line of like before and after because it just was your life, your whole life.
Yeah. So I'll give a quick like little high level view and then we can kind of dive into it. Because if you've been here for a long time, if you've followed my page for a long time, if you've been listening to podcasts, you know about this. So I apologize for repeating it for the 9 millionth time. But for the people that don't know, my brother has a disability called cri du chat. It's cry of the cat syndrome. And in utero during development, his, put very, very simply, his fifth chromosome. So as the chromosomes develop, they split apart and they come back together a couple different times. And his fifth one just split apart and stayed split and never came back together. So it was a total fluke. Neither of my parents are genetic carriers for the condition. My parents didn't know that he had that. All of the ultrasound scans had been normal. Also, they thought he was a girl.
Were those related at all?
No. No, they think he might have just like had his legs crossed or it was like the positioning of whatever.
Yeah, that was probably before blood tests because now they do it with a blood test.
Yeah. I mean, it was 1993. So.
Yeah.
So I was the oldest. My mom had had like a typical pregnancy and delivery with me and I had had typical development up until that point. I was 2.5 when he was born. So my parents go to the hospital thinking everything's going to be fine. Very fast labor, my mom says. And he was actually very tiny. And when he was born, they at first were like, oh, it's a boy. And my parents were like, ah, no way. And then they noticed that when he started crying, all of the nurses immediately looked at the OB. And there was like 2 or 3 nurses that were in the room and they all like looked at the OB because his cry made him sound like a kitten. Very high pitched, very like, not a typical baby cry. And they whisked him away. And my parents were like, what is happening? Because keep in mind, they'd had a typical experience with me. So they kind of knew or thought they knew like what they were getting into. And so the OB came in and he was like, well, we think there might be a problem. And so they did a bunch of tests. And then 2 weeks later, they called my parents back in and said, he has this condition. My parents asked a bunch of questions and their basic refrain was, we don't know. We don't know. The average life expectancy at the time was 4 years old. And my parents are like, is he going to walk? They're like, maybe. Like, is he going to talk? We don't know. And they actually said that my parents didn't have to take him home. They said the majority of special needs babies were handed over to the state.
I wonder if that was like the statistics are still like that or if that was also the 90s.
I don't know if it was that. I mean, it was still it was almost early enough to be like still the 80s in some ways. So it was just, it was wild. And my parents were like, well, no, like we're taking our son home. So we were living in Phoenix, Arizona at the time. And my dad is from Calgary, Alberta, and his parents, who were both still living, still lived up there. Their children's hospital up there actually had some of the best early childhood disability care. We moved up there for a couple of years to kind of get settled. And I've actually never asked my parents, like, beyond that, why they moved up there. I kind of wonder if it was for some support too, because I spent quite a lot of time with my grandparents then, which, like, obviously, yeah, but I'm just all of a sudden realizing now I've never asked the specifics regardless. So then he stopped meeting developmental milestones at about 3.
Okay.
So he is now 32 and he is 5'8" and he is very funny. And I think he is much smarter than he lets people think that he is. I think he can be a little bit manipulative, and that's okay. We still love him. But he can walk. He has a very unsteady gait. He can trip pretty easily. He can't really run. Like, even when he tries to run, it's kind of a shuffle. He has decent dexterity, but he wouldn't be, like, he can't hold like a fork or spoon or a knife. So his lunch is usually like a finger food. 9 times out of 10, it is some sort of chicken nugget tender fry combo that he gets for lunch. And we force grapes and cucumbers in him to try to, like, balance out the health.
Give him some nutrients.
He has very low sensory tolerance. So we can't talk super loud. When we're together as a family, we have to keep it kind of like toned down, or he'll get like really antsy. He will sometimes have like sundowners in the evening where he'll have like an hour where he's like really cranky. Sometimes he'll get aggressive. I've been punched in the face. I've been kicked. He pinches. He wants me to wrestle him. It's called get off. That's literally the game that he calls it. And so you literally have to like lay across him like full body weight, and he tries to like wriggle out from under you. But the problem is, like, he tries to punch you. Like, he gets, like, way too aggressive with it. And so you have to tell him to chill out. He can stand in the shower, but he doesn't have the dexterity to wash himself. So we get him in the shower. He'll, like, kind of stand there. And then we have to, like, soap him up and, like, wash him. We have to brush his teeth, put his deodorant on. He's diapered. He doesn't use the bathroom. He also, like, he just wets the bed. Because he goes through the diaper. So every morning the routine is like, once he's ready, he'll stay in bed until like 1. And we're like, oh, okay. Wow. Like And sometimes like it won't, he'll usually get up once he's gone to the bathroom, if that makes sense. Like we kind of we don't just like force him to like sit in it. That's not it. Yeah. But sometimes he won't have gone and he's not ready to get up. And it's not like he has a job or has to go to school. So it's like, you know, my parents just kind of do their own thing. But when he's ready to get up, we have to strip the bed, clean the bed, shower him, wash him, get him all cleaned up. He loves Axe body spray. He calls it push push. So he needs push push. So we put on push push, and then he has a plethora of t-shirts and basketball shorts. Mm-hmm. He has slip-on Skechers sneakers. Mm-hmm. And that is his life. And he goes for like little walks during the day. He takes meds 3 times a day for like behavior stuff and like stress management, anxiety management, and mood stabilizers and all that. And he watches cartoons, and he will have his TV going with his iPad going. He knows how to navigate the iPad. I've asked him, I'm like, why can you use an iPad, but you can't use the toilet? And he just ignores me. He doesn't even look at me. He just keeps scrolling on the iPad. I paint that picture to say, like, when we go home, it is all hands on deck. He will yell in the night. And sometimes that's because, like, he's kicked off his blanket. Or sometimes even it'll just be that his feet are sticking out of his blanket. And he'll yell and be like, fix it, the blanket! Fix it, the blanket! And so when Kendra, my sister, and I go home, we try to get up so that my parents can have a break. Some nights he'll sleep through the night. Mm-hmm. And then other times he'll yell like 5 or 6 times. But we've also learned like the routines during the day that will like tire him out. He needs at minimum like 1 to if not 2 walks. He needs a couple of outings, which is basically driving him through the drive-through. He used to like walking around stores and things, but he doesn't want to do that anymore. And so, yeah, he just we live to serve him. Mm-hmm. And it's been hard.
Yeah. I think it's shaped your life in probably every aspect. But where do you want to start with how it's shaped your life?
It's shaped everything about who I am. There's no part of me that has not been touched by him because it was so foundational to what was happening when I was growing up. I'm very lucky in that I've had a mom and a dad who have gone and done their work. And so we're able to talk about it like very openly.
Was that the case growing up, or was there a period of time where you couldn't?
It was not that you couldn't, but we kind of had the like pick yourself up by the bootstraps. This is what it is. So you have to do it attitude. I kind of got that pressure the worst. And I think Kendra would agree with that. Kendra has had a lot of responsibility with him, but in like childhood age, there were a lot of expectations on me and I had a lot of anxiety and I was really stressed about things. And like, I wouldn't do certain social things because I felt like I needed to be home. And I didn't realize that's what that tension was until I got older and started processing it. But there were times where like, I would want to stay like after school to do something. And I would get like really anxious during the day, like thinking about not being home right away. And I would just like get on the bus and like go home. And this was never my parents telling me that I had to be home, or like that was never ever the case.
Yeah.
But it was all like unspoken. Like as the oldest daughter and the oldest child who in a lot of ways became parentified very quickly, I had this perspective of like, oh, like I gotta be home. Gotta be home for the kids. You know, like that was
yeah.
That was what happened. And so, or even like when I would have friends over, the way he would behave, like I had this deep knowing that my house was not a fun house because of him. And my dad traveled a lot for work at the time. And so that added to the complexity of it. Like my mom was managing all of this alone. And I was like, trying to help. And Kendra was, I mean, there's a 6-year age gap between Kendra and I. So even when I was like 12, Kendra was 6. No 6-year-old should have like that much responsibility. But he would pull our hair. He would beat us up. He would be very demanding. He would have these meltdowns and we would have to navigate it. And like, just like the tension and the stress. And we stopped going to the store with him. Like it would have to be like someone had to stay home with him while others went to the store or went out, because he like from a sensory level, like couldn't handle it. And I was so good at taking care of people. And I remember I just blended in with the adults. Like I just had this very like innate understanding of like struggle and like, yeah, you know, life's hard. And adults would like relate to me and they'd be like, I know. And I'd be like, it's crazy. Stress. And like I did, at the time, I'm like, nobody thought that was weird. That like as a 35-year-old, you were relating wholeheartedly to a 13-year-old. And that I was relating to you, that I was like having these conversations of like, yeah, man, responsibility. It's hard to balance. And I know, and you and I have had this conversation a million ways to Sunday. I absolutely know that is the trauma of mine that pulled me to the caregiving field. Totally. I was so naturally good at it. And even like with my friends, like I knew how to hold space. I knew how to talk to them. I knew how to like tend to them. Mm-hmm. And it was the same way when I got out of school. I was in some very like codependent friendships for a while when I was in college. Also, like I came from a religion that was very like service oriented and all of that. And so it really messed me up. And there was a long period of time, and this I've talked about this in the hospital episode as well, but there was a crossover in the hospital where I was so resentful of myself. I hated myself for choosing the career that I chose and realizing like how many other things I was good at, how many other interests I had, how smart I like really actually was. But then also this recognition that my parents did not have the space and the time to invest in me in the way they could have if Alex had been normal. And that it was just everybody in that time period was in survival mode, trying to get through and figure it out. And I had a lot of resentment towards my dad for a long time because I felt like he got to escape it because he got to go away. And then he would come home and I would have to babysit Alex so that him and my mom could go out and do things. And I just very much felt like it got put on me.
It's a lot, Sam.
It's a lot, a lot, a lot. And I've carried that responsibility for a very, very long time. And in the early 2010s is when we all individually as a family kind of started thinking of things differently. And there were some things that happened, that some changes that happened, that we all kind of went to our separate corners and went to therapy and kind of started to figure things out. And now my parents have been very generous in other ways to compensate for some of those sacrifices, because I still make them.
Yeah. No, you still go home a lot.
Yeah. I go home. I help out. I go so that they can go places. When my dad was going in the throes of his cancer, I was home for basically 6 weeks, and I was balancing working full time while taking care of Alex, while helping with my dad. My life has been very difficult in a lot of ways and has been very different compared to most people. And I think I am prone to the, well, I have A, B, C, D, E, F, G. So that means like I can't have that over here. And I spent a lot of years saying like, well, he can't help it. He can't control it. And it was very powerful for me when I was able to realize like I could hate him from time to time. Like I could be resentful of him. I could be bitter towards him. I could be angry at the way he impacted my life. The things that his condition stole from my childhood and the opportunities that I didn't get to have. Like I did not have a normal childhood. And I think one of the questions that really struck me one time was someone said, oh, your childhood wasn't that bad. Would you have wanted your child to have your childhood? Mm-hmm. And I was like, that was a rude fucking question. Because no, like I wouldn't. And I think it's a concern I have to think about having kids, but I can't, like, there's nothing you can do to control that. But it's in the back of your mind of like, oh my God, like, what would I do?
Yeah.
And my sister and I are both, you know, she's almost 30. She's 29 and a half. I'm 34. I turned 35 in 4 weeks. And, you know, we sometimes talk to each other about like, do you want kids? Do you want kids? Yeah. And the thing that we realized is like, we had a kid.
Mm-hmm.
I raised a kid. But the only difference is I didn't get the benefit of like seeing them grow. Like it's just been the same. I've done diapers and baths and feeding and caring and managing tantrums. And like I have done that my whole life. We both kind of have the recognition, and our parents understand it too, of like, I'm not rushing to have an infant, because I've lived that life. And I've had to be very cautious in sitting with like, well, is that my trauma talking? Or is that my real feeling? And I think sorting through that, I've realized like, no, I think some of that is my trauma. I'm someone that I would like the chance to be a mom. I would like to have a baby or two. Yet I'm also not like panicked for it to happen, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
But that took like some hashing through as well. It's such a big question when people say like, how did this shape your life? Because it's shaped everything. It still does. And you know, even like there's been times where like I've been afraid to think of like bringing a guy home because I feel so stressed thinking of like subjecting someone to that, which is so unfair like to me, and also like unfair to whoever this future mythical man is, that he wouldn't want to like hold space for that. It's very lonely when you know other people aren't used to it. And you're afraid of like, what are people going to think of him? And like, but what are they going to think of us? Like, are they not going to like us? They don't want to spend time with us. And I would feel a lot of that tension when I was growing up. And I was very lucky. I had like some really, really lovely friends in high school that I'm still close to today, who were always like so kind and understanding about it. And if any of them are listening, which I think some of them might be, you know who you are. And just thank you for not leaving me out. I remember what it was like when you would come over and how it would sometimes be really stressful. And if you're listening to this, just thank you. Because it was so lonely, and it was just this like very deep awareness of how not normal it was. Yeah, it's just like an ever-evolving part of my life. And it changes and shifts depending on the season that I'm in and, you know, other factors in my life and the work that I'm doing, like on a personal level. I think one of the biggest things that I just feel really grateful for is that my parents have matured with it as well. Mm-hmm. And I think that I'm willing to still help and to still be a part of it, because that's my family.
Yeah.
And that's a value of mine. And I'm willing to do that, but they're also willing to like do that for me, knowing that they can't show up in the typical ways. They've tried really hard to show up in other ways.
Like they can't visit you here.
Yeah.
And things right. like that, I would imagine.
I remember one time, and my supervisor who was helping me get my hours for my L, my mom had bought me something and she got upset at that.
That's so weird.
She did. Like we were sitting in the office and I was like, oh yeah, like my mom's really nice. She bought, I don't even remember what the thing was. I just remember said, oh yeah, my mom bought me that. And she's like, woo, someone's spoiled. And I turned to her and I said, shut the fuck up. Truly shut the fuck up. You would never do what I've done. I know you. I know you would never, ever, ever, ever do what I've done because I hear the way you talk about your kids. So I don't want to hear it that I flew home for 4 days to help take care of my brother and my mom offered to get me something in return. That's the other isolating thing too, is so many people don't understand the caregiving journey. You become this like blank vessel of projection for people to just like assume what would stress them out or assume what they couldn't handle. Just talking to you all the time about like how incredible you are, but then realizing like they really don't mean that in a compliment. Like they feel bad for me. And it's really frustrating when like you try to talk about it with people and people will be like, oh my God, you're a saint.
Right. It's like pretty dismissive.
Where do you go from there? Like, so I'm perfect.
Right. Then you can't actually share about how it impacts you.
I can't share how hard it is. I can't share about how the fact like when I come home and I go through the airport, I'm afraid people are going to think I'm a battered woman because I have bruises all over my forearm. Yeah. Because he thinks it's funny when he pinches me. And he'll like catch me when I'm like least expecting it. Or he'll like, I'll use this like right forearm if he starts like punching.
Yeah.
I use that to kind of block until I can get up and get out of the way. I think what's so isolating is sometimes people get so overwhelmed at thinking of what their life would be if they had that situation. Yeah. That they kind of shut you down with this like generic like, oh my God, you're a perfect angel baby saint. And nobody can touch you and you're on a pedestal now and I hope you're okay. I've learned enough that when people say that, the conversation's over. I think that for me sometimes is the most difficult part is understanding like how few people even care to try to understand what it is. Like everybody always kind of assumes that it's like, oh, it must be the diapers or it must be like that he gets aggressive. Yeah. And it's like, no, it's the fact that I desperately wish my brother didn't have to live this way. Because he's in pain. He's suffering. He's not in a good place. He's not healthy. And he's not. He has bruising on his brain from what they think are like mini strokes that he's had. Mm-hmm. He has an enlarged heart. He has a malformed kidney. He has low to no muscle tone. So his bowels essentially don't work. He's like chronically constipated. I think a lot of people assume there's certain things that are hard, but it's I grieve a standard relationship with a brother. I grieve what it's putting my parents through. I grieve what it's put me and my sister through. I grieve how it impacts us as a family unit. Like it is so much bigger than just, oh, like I have to change my brother's diaper. Like it is so much more layered than that. And as someone who is a chronic caregiver, my heart really goes out to people that become caregivers out of nowhere. Whether it's because your family member goes through an accident and their abilities change, whether it's because your parent suddenly gets sick or your parent develops dementia or Alzheimer's or ALS or MLS or one of these horrific diseases, or something happens to your child and they're sick. Like the overnight switch, I can't fathom to go from having to not do that at all to having to do that all the time. But the principles are still the same. Whether it's like acute or it's chronic, it's absolutely exhausting and overwhelming and it challenges you and it pushes you to the edge. It is a very, very like challenging reality.
I would love to share with you my Practice Therapy for Women Center. We are based in the Philly area. We have 4 office locations there, but we also have licensed therapists in 42 states across the country. So if you've been searching for a therapist and haven't found the right fit, I would love you to check out our website, therapyforwomencenter.com. I think it's so interesting too, Sam, because I think just like the whole way we talk about caregiving, we talk about it like it's like a dirty word kind of, and like it's not dignified, and we look down on people a lot of times. I mean, like if you're talking about nurses or people who do caregiving, like physical caregiving for work. And I think it's so interesting. I don't know if you've heard of, her name is Elisa Strauss, I believe. And she wrote a book called When You Care. And it's The Unexpected Magic of Caring for Others. And it's very interesting, her work, about how she kind of talks about how we look down on caregiving because it's tied to women's work. And we judge, right, any work that is stereotypically female as that. And it just reminded me a lot of what you were talking about with, even though this isn't exactly the same, I just think it's like such an interesting concept of how we put people on pedestals who do this caregiving work, as you were saying. And I feel the urge to do that sometimes when you talk about it, because I, in my current reality, right, struggling with one child.
Right. Yeah.
I am like, this is embarrassing that I am struggling or whatever. I think your point about you don't really have a choice and everyone's capacity is different, and people just imagine what it would be like in their current life. And I have a little bit of perspective on that, because I think it's really interesting as a society we're exploring more, like, do you want to have children? One of the biggest things is like, could I live with a child who had severe disabilities? And that was a huge reason that I was very scared of having children. And I think I sort of labeled myself as someone who could never
do that.
Be a good caregiver or whatever. Right. Like, I'm too selfish. I'm too this. I have too many mental health problems, whatever.
Right.
And I think the experience of having a child has very much changed my opinion about that. Not that I want that by any means, but I think to your point, it's like very few people choose this unless it's your career. It is something that happens, and the love you have for the person, your family, your values, your duty, whatever, is that you just do it. It hurts our humanity when we put people up on pedestals as these are the people who can do it, and then there are people who cannot do it. And it disconnects us from like recognizing that people do it and they still struggle and they have feelings and they're still human.
I appreciate that, because I think something, because I know I just went on this like long tear-filled rant of like how challenging it's been, because it has. And it has also made me an emotional oak tree. The thing that I feel very lucky for is I have realized that being hardwired for struggle, as all humans are in many ways, to allow that to be honed has given me so much capacity in other areas of my life, and understanding and perspective of like hard and challenge, and how you can step up to those things and how you can do things and push yourself to places that you didn't think was possible, but you can. You can meet yourself there. You are capable of meeting really big, challenging moments. And I think something that I don't give myself enough credit for is when my dad had cancer, when he was in the thick of it, when we found out the diagnosis and he needed multiple different surgeries. And I went home, came back, went again for like a long period of time, that I cared for my brother. I was emotionally holding space for my mom. I was helping care for my dad. And I was a therapist full time.
Yeah.
And I just kind of look at some people and I go, I promise you can handle this. Mm-hmm. And I don't say that from a judgmental place. I say that from an empowering place. I feel very lucky that I've had something that's allowed me to kind of be like tested in the fire and to be pushed and to be humbled and to realize like it's not always about you and that that's okay. Sometimes it needs to be about you, absolutely, but it doesn't have to be as often as you think it does. And I think parenthood does something similar in that realization, if you're committed to doing it correctly, I think. That sense of humility that you can actually find like tremendous joy in caring for someone and nurturing someone. The funny little moments that you share and little like inside jokes. I can get that kid laughing like you wouldn't believe. And it's the funniest thing. And he has this like kind of funny, he doesn't laugh like you or I, like he kind of does this like like this like choke act stuff. Yeah. And that's how you know he's like really finding it funny. To be someone that this vulnerable person trusts and feels safe with is a really, really beautiful thing. And I think special needs, I don't know what to say. I said that one time and someone yelled at me and said, I'm not supposed to say special needs. If that's offensive to you, I'm sorry. It's the phrase I grew up using. If people with disabilities, people who are differently abled, I think they get dismissed because people are so intimidated by it.
Because they haven't done it.
Yeah, they haven't done it. They're terrified of doing their own thing. Like the amount of people in public, most people are like very nice, but some people would just get like really freaked out, like when they see my brother, like they don't know what to do. And it's really awkward. And I just think like if you are a caregiver, I hope that this is a conversation that is bringing you some peace of mind to say like all of this gets to be true. The goodness that I find in it, the gratitude that I have for it as an experience, while also acknowledging like how unfair it feels at times and how I wish a lot of things could have been different, not because I want to take away any of the pain, but because I just wish my family could have felt typical. Because we actually like, we really like each other. That's what's hard too, is like my family's actually really close and we can't go on vacation, the four of us, because someone has to stay with him. And he gets really anxious when my parents are like gone for too long, even when it's like my sister or I watching him. So he has a couple of caregivers that come in and help, but like outside of my parents or me and my sister, but he wouldn't do well being like overnight. And we've just kind of accepted that like that's our life. But if you haven't, if you know somebody who is in a position where they're caregiving, check in with them. And my insight would be like, ask them how they're doing. Because it's really easy to ask about the person. Obviously, that's very fair. You want to know if they're okay or if they're doing okay or if they need anything. But don't be afraid to like sit in that vulnerable space with the person doing the caregiving, because it is very lonely. It's very isolating. Everybody's situation is different. Everybody's access to resources is different. And I think to practice realizing like you don't have to know what to do, because that person already knows what to do. They just really want connection and community. Because more often than not, when there's someone in your life that you're caregiving for, there are restrictions to what you can do in the community across conditions and diagnoses and whatever, right? And so for them to know that there are people that are thinking about them and aware of them and involving them, like that is huge. And so if you know someone who's in a situation like that, be there for them. And also, if you are a caregiver, open up to people that you trust, because I think more people around you would like to be supportive, but they don't know how, and they're afraid of stepping on your toes or, you know, making you feel like you're not good at what you're doing, right? But like for you to ask for the support that you need and to take care of yourself as best you can, because that is so hard and it feels so impossible when you're balancing all of that.
I'm hearing like people often talk to, they either put people on pedestals or they kind of treat you with kid gloves.
Yes.
And there isn't just that like human to human level.
Yeah. Because it's chronic.
Well, I think the other thing that you mentioned, I think it is a serious thing. And I think you and Ken, I remember when you guys first started talking, like you bring a lot of levity and humor and you can laugh about it and you can have different emotions about it. And I think people feel like I must be very serious or I'm like laughing at the thing. And I think that's important, because that is humanity, right? Is like laughing in the face of all of this. It is being mad while you're still doing it. It's feeling like this is extremely mm-hmm. important work, but it's also mm-hmm. ridiculous what you may have mm-hmm. to do or things like that. And I think people get that with parenthood. That is like a normal conversation, but it is different, I think, with caregiving. And that's been one thing I've been surprised about with having a child, is just you also can't, I think so many people are overwhelmed by it because they're like, I can't imagine these terrible moments. And I think, you know, I've talked a lot on this podcast and with you about my theories about mm-hmm. how the internet is ruining our brains because we have – everything is so frictionless.
Right.
And there is nothing I can think of that is less – that involves more friction than caregiving.
Uh-huh.
Because it is like a very physical act.
Yes.
And it is sort of – and I think just what you were talking about with just being very rooted and things like that. And I think you learn that emotions pass. You will learn that everything gets better. And I've learned that a little bit with like having a child of a tantrum doesn't last forever. A phase doesn't last forever. The feeling you have doesn't last forever. And you also can't cherry pick the best moments. And if you didn't help with your brother the way you did, you wouldn't have a lot of probably your favorite memories. And that is what is so messy and weird about caring for another person. And I'm sure – I haven't read that book, but I'm sure that's what she talks about in that book of just the layers of it.
Yeah. Well, like I'll give you like a really quick example. So he loves DVDs, but he doesn't put them in the box. He stacks. So it, like on his bookshelf, he has like these three massive stacks of just like DVDs. And he likes to sort through them. And he'll just like be in his room doing it. But sometimes they'll like spill over on the floor. And of course, he would never clean those up. So he calls you in to clean them up. And he's like, clean it up. And you're like, huh. So one time I'm down on the floor cleaning it up. And he starts to try to kick me. And he had been like kind of testy all through that day. And I was like, dude, stop. And I pushed him down the bed. And then he sat down on the bed. But then he kind of started trying to like hit me. And I'm like on the floor, like picking up these DVDs. And I'm like, what the fuck is this? Like, this is so stupid. So I stand up. And I like kind of put the DVDs back in and I'm like, there you go, buddy. Fuck you. And all of a sudden, like I walk out and he goes, fuck you. And I turned around and he had this like huge smile on his face. And I realized that like for him, he thought that whole exchange was like so funny.
Yeah.
And in a way, I started laughing because I was like, he's still a brother. Like,
yeah.
Even though he has, you know, he doesn't function the same as like a typical brother, he's behaving like a brother. He's trying to piss me off. He's trying to rile me up. He wants to get like a reaction out of me. And then my mom will be like, who taught you to swear? And he's like, Sammy. And she's like, is that naughty? And he's like, Sammy's naughty. I'm like, okay, whatever. He's like such a freaking stool pigeon. He tells on everybody. He'll announce if, you know, someone did this mean. He will try to blame Kendra and I for things when we're not home. Like my parents will go in his room and be like, who made this mess? And he's like, Kendra. Like it's just like he does stuff. It's just like, you know, he's still like brother-ish. And so it's by far like the hardest thing I've been through in my life because it is so chronic and present. But it also is like the most powerful. And I think it was really, really helpful for me in my processing of this chronic experience to accept that both exist. Mm-hmm. And I think to anybody that is caregiving, I don't care what the situation is, I just really invite you to like practice letting all of it be true. Mm-hmm. Letting the messiness of it be true, that to be disappointed that this is your reality, to be angry that this is your reality, that's healthy because it's not typical.
I think we normalize a lot when someone gets sick.
Yes.
Right? Like I'm thinking about my mom's cancer and like my dad became her caregiver and there is a lot of anger there and it is all sort of anger at the disease. And I wonder if there is a more difficult, confusing element of when someone has a chronic disability, whether it is harder to externalize the problem because it is more them versus there was a before and there is an after.
Yeah, I struggled with it for years. And I think it is so different and vast and varied depending on the severity of the disability and the needs required for the caregiver. I also have like such a different perspective now of what I think would be difficult caregiving because I feel like I have been so deep in the trenches.
Yeah.
Like I really don't think a baby would feel that like earth shattering to me.
Yeah. Probably not. It's very physically intense, but like simple in some ways.
But like they're little and they don't punch me. Well, yeah, maybe they do. But like it's just the spectrum is just so vast. And however, the universality of it getting to be difficult for your situation is still true. And even if you have all of these other amazing things over here that maybe make it easier or more manageable, or it's not as hard as this, or it could be worse or whatever, that doesn't take away from the challenge that you are facing. Mm-hmm. And all of the good can be there, and we can take solace in what is good and what works well. And if we have good resources and if we have everything that we need, while also being like, and it also sucks. Like it sucks that this is what we need to do and that we're being put through this and that this person who I love and care about is in this type of pain and trapped inside of a body that doesn't feel like it works all the way. And it all is true. And whatever your situation is, I would like invite you to practice letting yourself have that freedom to acknowledge like how vast the spectrum is and how it changes day to day, hour to hour, minute to minute sometimes, and that's okay.
Well, I think this was a really powerful episode, Sam, and I think a lot of people are going to relate to it, and I think everyone will appreciate your vulnerability.
Yeah, I hope so. It's hard because I spent a lot of time isolating myself, saying that like, oh, people don't this, people don't that, like, or don't want to hear it or whatever. But for me, being able to like speak truth to it, I hope that whatever you're going through in your life, even if you're not a caregiver, even if you're just going through something that feels really challenging and heavy and unfair, for you to know that like it all gets to be true, and that you are allowed to use this as an opportunity to tap into a part of yourself that you didn't know existed, and to see it as empowering that you're being asked to step up to the moment rather than a punishment, and that you get this opportunity to be really, really special.
And that doesn't mean everything happens for a reason. It just means that you can create meaning out of it.
Yeah. And that me being able to do that really made it far more manageable for me to see it as an opportunity for me rather than like a curse. And I have some days where I feel like it's a curse. Don't get me wrong. When I start feeling really low, I try really hard to tap into letting that exist, letting that be real, while then letting myself sit in what I'm proud of about it. And it feels messy and it's a lot and it's weird. But whatever you're going through, I think to allow yourself to practice that can really buy you some mental space, if you will.
Love it. Well, thanks everyone for listening. We have some really great episodes on Substack if you want to join us over there. We have one that is going to be coming out soon about who gets to critique and critique culture. If you read the book All the Way to the River by Liz Gilbert or want to hear our thoughts on that, we have that one. As always, if you ever have specific ideas, thoughts, topics you'd like us to cover, you can DM us. You can email us at podcast@therapyforwomencenter.com.
Also, if you might have noticed, there were ads in this. Woo! We did it.
People are like, no.
No, we're sorry. We had to do it. We're sorry.
We need to be able to be compensated for how much time we spend on this.
We have to do it. We're sorry. So we thank you for being here. And if the ads didn't kill you too much, if you could rate, review, share, subscribe, anything that you can do to get the word out about the pod means the world to us. And that's all.
We'll see you next week.
Bye.